You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
My name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and yesterday I had the great pleasure of speaking with Robin Bernstein. She is a professor at Harvard, a cultural historian, an American historian. She's in charge of the American Studies program at Harvard, and also teaches in the African and African American Studies Department and of Studies of Women, Gender, and Sexuality, all at Harvard. And the occasion for our conversation is her book, her fascinating book, entitled Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. And it talks about events that took place in Auburn, New York. The book is fascinating. I actually just started it because it just arrived after my conversation, and I'm devouring it. Again, Dr. Robin Bernstein, and the book Freeman's Challenge. So hello, everybody. Welcome again, Curiosity Invited. And today I am with Robin Bernstein, that other person on the screen that doesn't look like me. And we're here to talk about, a bunch of stuff, but it all grows out of the book that Robin wrote, one of several that Robin has written and published. It's okay if I call you Robin. Do you want me to call you something else? Yes. Okay. Okay, good. And anyway, thank you for being here. And the book, which at this point will show up on your screen, but it is not here now, is Freeman's Challenge. It's called Freeman's Challenge. And thank you for coming, and thank you for being willing to spend a little time into speaking about the book and what underlies the book. It's interesting, right? So the book is about, right, this event, but this event brings a much larger conversation to the surface, and hopefully we'll talk about all that. But might you start by giving us a mini bio of who you are and where you are and how you got there and all those books behind you?
Sure. I'm Robin Bernstein. I am a cultural historian. I focus on the history of race from the 19th century to the present. And I have a particular interest in childhood and youth studies, and also a particular interest in theater and performance, how people talk to each other in the 19th century through live performance. Live performance back then did a lot of the work that TV and the internet does today. So I'm really interested in how people negotiate power between themselves. I teach at Harvard University. I teach in the Department of African and African American Studies and in Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. I'm also the chair of the program in American Studies. My hope is that American Studies is a wonderful location from which to understand this beautiful country. I love the United States. I really and truly do. And that's part of the reason that I study what I study.
And so, okay. So can we start with Freeman's Challenge. So, it was, as I understand it, springs from the imprisonment ultimately a murder of violence against both freemen and others. And so could you talk about the circumstances of that particular event or those events And then where it goes from there.
Yeah. Well, the full title of the book is Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. So the event that you're referring to is a murder.
Nice.
There is a murder in the book. It happens in the middle of the book. And what you find out in the opening pages, so I'm not spoiling anything, what you find out in the opening pages is that the murder is committed by William Freeman, who is the protagonist in the book. And I should say that when I say protagonist, I intended the book to read like a novel. I wanted it to read in a very compelling way where people would not be able to put it down. But every single word of this book is true. It is a completely true story, all of it based on historical documents. So the event that you're referring to is a murder. William Freeman was an African-American and also Native American teenager. He grew up in a small town in New York State called Auburn. It's in the Finger Lakes area. What makes Auburn really special is that it was the birthplace of a radical new idea, which was that a prison can and should be an economic force. Now, to us, that's really obvious. The idea that a prison can create jobs, for example, the fact that a prison can affect a local economy. To us, that's very self-evident. But the only reason it's self-evident is because a group of white businessmen in Auburn, New York, more than 200 years ago, came up with this idea. So this is the people in my book. The ideas that they invented are in me, are in you, are in everybody. So William Freeman just happened to be born in Auburn, the site of the Auburn State Prison, which was the original profit-driven carceral institution.
An institution that is still there, as we understand.
Yes, that's right. I'd love to talk about that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So he was part of the most prominent Black family in town. He was loved as part of this family. And he had a life that was in some ways very difficult. He was working from an early age, but in a lot of ways, it was a livable life. It was a good life. But everything changed for William Freeman in 1840, when he was 15 years old. He was accused of stealing a horse. There was no hard evidence against him, but that didn't matter. He was tried, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to 5 years hard labor in the Auburn State Prison, the original prison for profit. So William Freeman had...
Was it at the point when he was sent to Auburn Prison, was it already a prison for profit?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. It was from its inception. So the prison was, it began in 1816 before Freeman was even born.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very quickly made into this profit-driven prison. And it was part of the concept from the very beginning. There were actually industrial factories built into the prison. The prison itself was built on the banks of a river. And the reason it was built on the banks of a river was in order to capture the water power, in order to run machines
mm-hmm.
in the factories in the prison. So, and this is actually in the deed. I found the deed for the prison. And it's actually in the deed that there's going to be the capture of water power to power factories where prisoners are going to be forced to work. So the concept of forcing prisoners to work in industrial factories, that concept was in place literally before the prison was built. So this is a radical new kind of prison that was created in the North, not the South. And this is one of the really important points of the book. A lot of people associate prison for profit with the South after the Civil War. There's a really dominant story that carceral labor, convict leasing, chain gangs, that this kind of profit-driven carceral labor was created by the South after the Civil War as a way of reinstituting slavery by another name. And another way that this story gets told is that it's tied to the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The 13th Amendment states that forced labor is outlawed, quote, except as a punishment for crime, unquote. So in the eyes of a lot of people, what that did was it created a new form of slavery after chattel slavery was outlawed. But there are some things that are wrong with that story. One thing that's wrong with it is that, in fact, profit-driven incarceration, convict leasing, was invented not in the South, but in the North, and specifically in New York State.
And was this the first instance that you could find, or was it a concept that, you know, in Europe, they've been doing this for, 1300 years, was this the first instance, at least from what you've discovered?
There were related practices, of course. I mean, this was not a completely unprecedented practice. But what was really new in Auburn, and what I'm not aware of any other prison anywhere in the world doing, is that the prison was actually established for the purpose of creating profit. So before Auburn, prisons existed for some combination of three reasons. They existed either to punish, and or they existed to control people, basically to get people off the street, and or they existed to reform people, to help people become better in one way or another. But a group of white businessmen in Auburn, New York, said, to heck with all of that. We don't care about any of that. What we care about is profit. And they built the entire prison around the concept of profit. And that was radically new. So getting back to the story about the South and the Civil War, in fact, carceral slavery was invented in the North, not the South. It was invented in the wake of slavery. It was slavery by another name, but it was invented in the wake of Northern slavery, not Southern slavery. York State was a slave state. New York State had legal slavery until 1827. So it had chattel slavery in the same legal sense that the South did. Yeah. So, and in fact, slavery was throughout most of the North. So the North ended slavery before the South, and not that long before. So Connecticut, for example, had legal slavery until 1848. So the difference between the North and the South is a lot less than we expect, a lot less than we think. But New York State outlawed slavery in 1827. And so the problem with starting the story of prison for profit, if we start the story with the South and the Civil War, the problem with that is that we're starting the story in the middle. And when we start the story in the middle, what we're inadvertently doing is letting the North off the hook. What I wanted to do in Freeman's Challenge, the murder that shook America's original prison for profit, was put the North back on the hook.
Well, now I have a question about that, but I don't want to take away from just a couple of points about it. So he, meaning William Freeman, was accused of stealing a horse. Questionable whether in fact he did or not, but he was convicted, whatever that meant, and put in prison. And the labor was forced labor. So do you know something about that? Like, I don't want to work, says a prisoner. What happens then?
Well, that's exactly what William Freeman did say. So William Freeman had been free his entire life. His mother was born free. His father had been enslaved, but had become free. His grandparents had been enslaved, and they, in fact, had established Black Auburn, the Black community of Auburn. They had been the founders of that community, and they had also built a whole lot of white Auburn. So they had been enslaved, and they had become free. So Freeman, William Freeman, was part of the first fully free generation in his family. He was part of a rising free generation in New York State. Remember, when William Freeman was born in 1824, slavery still existed in New York, but he was part of this rising generation of free Black youth He was a kid. He was a teenager. And so he is convicted of this crime that he swore he did not commit. He is put into the Auburn State Prison, and he is told explicitly, you are a slave of the state. That was the language they used. And William Freeman was furious. He said on no uncertain terms that he was, that he deserved to be paid for his labor. He said he didn't want to work, and he didn't want to work for two reasons. One was that he had not committed a crime. The other reason he did not want to work was that he refused to work for no pay. The prisoners in the Auburn State Prison, they received literally nothing in exchange for their work. And when I say nothing, what I mean is no wages, no special privileges, no early release, literally nothing. They worked like slaves. They were enslaved. They were carceral slaves. And William Freeman spoke up, which was a very brave thing to do. The Auburn State Prison was an enormously violent place. And when William Freeman spoke up and said he did not want to work, the retribution was immediate, it was violent, and it was truly terrible.
And the retribution was visited upon him by guards, by fellow prisoners, by what?
Well, I mean, mostly by guards. But you're right, some of the other prisoners were forced to hold William Freeman down while he was beaten horribly by a guard. And the prisoners were forced to do that. They had, if they had refused, they would have been beaten.
They would have been in the same position, yeah.
And when I say beaten, I mean the beatings were truly awful. In the worst case, William Freeman was beaten by a guard over the head with a board. And this guard beat him with this board so badly that the board actually broke on William Freeman's head. And remember, this is a teenager. This is a kid. And the board broke on his head. It caused a terrible injury to his skull and his brain. And as a result of this beating, William Freeman became deaf.
So there was no, and by the way, the every prisoner had to work at some aspect of this industry that was embedded in the prison.
That's right.
Or part of the prison, right?
That's right. And I think one thing that's really important to say is that these factories were run by private corporations, private companies. And so the way it worked was that the prison had these factories inside the prison, and private companies would come in and take control of these factories that had been paid for by the state, by the way, to produce these factories. So a company would come in, they would lease the labor of prisoners. They would pay usually 35 cents a day per prisoner. And that money went directly to the prison, that none of the money went to the prisoners. So these companies were paying 35 cents per day per man, and they were all men, for this labor. The prisoners were making consumer goods. They were making things like carpets and furniture and guns, believe it or not, and farm machinery. In one case, at one point, they actually made railroad engines. So they made all sorts of consumer goods, big things and small things. And they were paid nothing for their work. Then the companies owned these consumer goods, and they took them and they sold them at profit. So this is the economic model of the prison.
This is happening at this prison only, or were there a lot of those different goods that you just mentioned? You know, they're very different from one another. That all happened at Auburn Prison. Like there was the locomotive building group, the gun building group, and the furniture building group, all in the same place.
Well, there were different factories and different companies.
In the prison, in this one prison, there were different
inside the prison. At times, there were as many as a dozen different factories.
Oh, wow.
And each factory was controlled by a different company. So different companies were manufacturing different goods. And you've asked a really interesting question about, was Auburn the only one doing this? The answer is, in the beginning, Auburn's model was unique, but people smelled money. And as you can imagine, the moment the prison was up and running and the moment it appeared to be succeeding in a lot of ways at making a whole lot of money, there were imitations very quickly. And what was called the Auburn model spread. And it spread first throughout New York, and then it spread to the Northeast, it spread south, and it spread west. So a lot of the prisons that we think of today as some of the most notorious and violent prisons, they were Auburn imitators, explicitly so. So Sing Sing, for example, in New York State was built on Auburn's model. San Quentin in California, Parchman, Angola, all of these prisons were built on Auburn's model. And now, of course, the basic idea that a prison can and should be an economic force, that idea is now everywhere. There's no prison in the entire world that is not affected in one way or another by that idea. So the Auburn model, it spread fast, it spread hard, and it spread everywhere.
And just so I can get a sense of the economics behind it, the ideas, well, I don't know if you were able to find this, but the idea for this model, for this prison, did it come from a bunch of businessmen approaching the state saying, hey, build us that? Or did it come from states or whoever? And then they approached business people and said, hey, we need somebody to run this factory here.
No, I can tell you exactly where it came from. So all of this is totally in the book. The idea, you know, what I'm really getting at is this bizarre and really diabolical idea that it's okay for one person to profit off of another person's incarceration. Why should I, as a non-incarcerated person, why should I derive any economic benefit from another person's incarceration? This is really the core idea that a group of white businessmen in Auburn came up with. And what I'm really trying to do in Freeman's Challenge is show how bizarre that idea is. There's nothing natural about it. There's nothing permanent about it. It was invented by a group of very flawed individuals who you can actually meet in my book. I name the names, and you can see how this idea came about. So I can tell you where the idea came from. At the time, this was 1816 in New York State, there was one prison, and it was called Newgate, and it was in Greenwich Village. And it was overrun, and it was very corrupt. And this was a prison that was based on the old model that I mentioned before, which is that prisons should exist for some combination of punishment and or control and or reformation. So Newgate was overrun. And so the state says, we need another prison. We need a second prison to punish people and control them and reform them. So they put out a message to towns in New York State. And they say, we're offering a contract of $20,000 to any town that will build a prison for these purposes. So what these white businessmen in Auburn, they had an extraordinary insight that nobody else had at the time. What they realized, $20,000 in 1816 is the equivalent of about $500,000 today. Now, Auburn was a tiny little village of about 2,000 people. So think about it. If you take a village of 2,000 people and you flush it with $500,000, all at once, with more money to come in every year forever to keep the prison up, that's going to completely change the economy of the town. Now, to you and me, that's common sense. That's obvious. But at the time, it was a new idea. It wasn't obvious at all. So these white businessmen, they had this insight that what they could do is they could get the state contract, use it to build a prison, sure. But really, what they were going to do with this money was transform Auburn from a village into a city. That's what they really wanted to do. So they were taking money from the state. So this was one income stream. And since their whole purpose was to make money, they didn't remember, they didn't care about justice. They didn't care about punishment. They didn't care about any of this. They cared about money. So they're taking money from the state, lots and lots of money from the state. And then they get this idea to build their prison around factories. So now they're taking money also from these corporations. Meanwhile, they're taking labor out of the prisoners. So they're deriving value from three different directions. And they even had some other directions that they were deriving value from. They were basically taking money and value from every entity that they could. And it worked. It worked. And they invented a new economic structure for prisons and for cities.
And so the $35, was it $35?
35 cents a day.
So the 35 cents a day that went to the prison was used to buy the prison to support the prison, or was used to,
No, they were getting money from the state to support the prison. What they were taking this money from companies for was themselves. It was a very
individuals who worked at the prison, in the prison workers, not the inmates, but
the employees.
Were being enriched, or at least some of them, right, by the 35 cents a day per prisoner.
That's exactly right.
And was there any suggestion that this was, I mean, I get it was a new model, so maybe nobody thought about it, but was this kosher? Was this a legal thing to do? Or
it was legal. Parts of it were legal and parts of it were not.
It wasn't illegal, so it was legal, right? Yes.
Well, yes and no. So part of the argument that they were making was that by taking money from these companies, they were saving the state money, that they were using this money for the upkeep of the prison, and therefore the state could give them less money. That was part of the argument and part of the justification. But part of what was happening was that the administrators of the prison, who were extremely corrupt, were simply stealing. They were simply taking the money from the state.
Yes.
Absolutely. They were taking money from the state, and they were taking money from the companies, and they were taking money from every direction they possibly could, and they were simply sticking it in their pockets.
Yeah.
So it was both illegal theft, and it was legalized theft, in the sense that slavery is a form of labor theft. Slavery can be legal. Slavery was legal at the time, but it is still a form of theft. It is a legal form of the theft of people's labor, of people's lives, of people's freedom. And it was combining both legal theft and illegal theft.
You know, maybe this is a footnote, or maybe this is a conversation that comes afterwards. But would you feel differently about it if it was voluntary? If it was, hey, we've got all these jobs. Anybody want to work? You're not going to get paid, but if you want to work, here, we got these jobs for you. And if people volunteered, would it be different from your point of view?
Well, I mean, here you're talking in part about today. So there are many different systems by which prisoners work today.
Right.
And many people who are incarcerated want to work, and they want to work for the same reasons that non-incarcerated people want to work. I want to work because it gives me meaning and it is satisfying to me. And people who are incarcerated want to work for all of the same reasons.
Sure.
So, but then the question becomes, what is the role of work in prisons? So there are some prisons today that are still basically built on the Auburn model, where prisoners are forced to work and they earn literally nothing. And to my mind, that is extremely wrong. They're forced to work. They have no choice and they earn nothing. And that is the case in many states. In other states, including today, New York, prisoners have a modicum of choice about whether to work or not, and they earn very low wages. So as you mentioned, the Auburn prison exists today, and this prison is where all New York State license plates are made. There are still factories inside the prison. In fact, the prison is still built around factories. It's the same prison. And so all New York State license plates are built in the Auburn prison, every single one of them. I want to add a note about what's happening right now today in Maine, the state of Maine. Maine has come up with a really interesting new model for carceral labor. What they have noticed is that there are new opportunities for everybody to do remote labor. There are all kinds of new tech jobs where you never have to go into an office. And what Maine is doing is they are experimenting with allowing incarcerated people to apply for tech jobs where the work is 100% remote. And when incarcerated people get these jobs, for which are skilled jobs, when they get these jobs, they are earning the same salary as a non-incarcerated person. The prison garnishes a small amount of the salary in order to pay room and board, that kind of thing, kind of analogous to the rent a person would be paying if they were not incarcerated. But the bottom line is that the people in Maine who are part of this program are earning real salaries, and they are able to save their money. But the number one thing that they do with this money that they are earning, one of the most popular things for them to do with it, is pay child support. Because like many non-incarcerated people, lots of people in prison have children and need to pay child support. And if you are earning 65 cents an hour, which is what the license plate workers in New York earn, if you're earning 65 cents an hour, you are not able to pay child support. Mm-hmm. And who is suffering? Your child. Sure. Your child is suffering.
Sure.
And your child's other parent is suffering. But in Maine, these folks in prisons are earning real salaries. They are able to pay child support. They're able to pay all kinds of other bills. And they're also able to save money. And then when they get out of prison, first of all, they have real savings. They can go get themselves an apartment. They can put down a down payment on an apartment for rent or even to buy potentially. They also have a real resume. They can say, you know, here are the things that I've done in my job. And it's not just I stamped license plates for, you know, 30 years. They have a real resume. They have savings and they have real skills. And they have the potential to build good lives after incarceration.
And has this practice been implemented? Has this policy, this experiment been implemented, and it's working?
Yeah. It's relatively new, so they don't have longitudinal data yet. But this is happening in Maine. I think it's great. One thing that I want to be really clear about is that I'm not criticizing work. I think that non-incarcerated people want to work for the most part, and incarcerated people want to work.
I know who's ever reveals something about me. Everybody I know who's been in prison, absolutely, jobs are sought after, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, and jobs are sought after for nobody talks about the money they make or didn't make, or they talk about it. It's because otherwise you go stir crazy. Right.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that people want.
Yeah.
And who doesn't?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There are lots of good reasons to want to work, and nobody should be forced to work for no pay. And that's what happened to William Freeman. William Freeman was forced to work for no pay, and William Freeman challenged the Auburn state system. He said, "I don't want to work." What?
Can we go back to that for just a second to finish that piece of the story? So William Freeman said, no, I don't want that. He was beaten badly, punished badly. Is there a, because not everybody's read that book, but is there a happy ending to this story?
Well, I don't want to talk about the ending. I don't want to give away the ending. I hope people will read the book. But there is a murder in the book. We haven't talked about that yet.
Yeah.
So William Freeman got out of prison in 1845, and he gets out. He's now 20 years old. He's been incarcerated for a quarter of his life. He's now deaf, and he's furious that the state has, from his perspective, stolen 5 years of labor from him. He's more angry about that than he is about having been deafened. He believes that the state owes him back pay. That's the way he explains it to himself, that then he explains it to everybody else, that the state has stolen 5 years of labor from him, and now they owe him back pay. What he does is he tries to launch a legal campaign to recover stolen wages, wages that were stolen by the state. And that is how he expresses it. So he goes to lawyers. He tries to get them to represent him. And he is laughed at and he is dismissed. He persists for 6 months. And then he converts his goal. His previous goal had been back pay. He converts it to payback. And that's where the murder comes in. So William Freeman committed a murder, and it was a truly terrible crime. And I don't understate that in the book in any way. He committed a truly horrible murder. And the murder terrified the entire region. And part of the reason the murder was so terrifying was not simply because it was a murder, because let's face it, there are lots of murders. So it wasn't just the fact that it was a murder. What was so frightening about the way Freeman challenged the Auburn State Prison was that the people he killed were not directly connected to his incarceration. And that made it really terrifying. Because think about it, if he had killed the guard who had beaten him over the head, for example, I mean, that would be really terrible, but people could say, oh, wow, that's so awful, but that has nothing to do with me. But instead, what William Freeman did was he killed four random people, and they were white people. And the reason this was so terrifying, so threatening, was that it was basically an act of terrorism. This is how terrorism works. If you say, you know, why did that person die and I didn't in an act of terrorism? The answer is there is no reason.
Right.
It could have been you. And that's really frightening. And what William Freeman accomplished by committing an act of terrorism was he named a truth, which was that everybody was economically implicated in this prison system. And he was right. Everybody, every single person in the entire region was tied economically to the prison in one way or another, because Auburn became a kind of one company town. So in a way, it didn't matter if you worked for the prison or not. You were still economically, directly or indirectly entangled with the prison. And that was the truth that he named by killing people who seemed random, but in fact, they were implicated in the Auburn prison because everybody was.
Were there other people? This is probably too far in the weeds, but, you know, humor me. Were there other people working at the prison, in the prison factories, who were not prisoners? In other words, you know, you got the prisoners working here, and then, you know, your neighbor is working here, and he's not getting paid anything, and I'm getting paid whatever.
Well, what you had was foremen. So you know, the companies were running these factories, so the companies were putting foremen in the factories.
Right. But
no, yeah. No, all of the men worked all the machines. Yeah. They were all incarcerated.
Yeah, I get it. Okay. Well, so you know, and this just is a demonstration of my ignorance. Maybe everybody knows this, but there's been a lot of discourse over the last 20 years, maybe even less, but about, for-profit prisons. And so much so that I thought, it was a novel idea that people had that turns out to be a terrible idea. Terrible idea, but, and so was being phased out. So that's obviously not true.
A lot of people use the phrase prison for profit when what they actually mean is private prison. So a private prison is where the prison itself is literally owned by a company.
Got it.
And it is a company that runs the prison itself for the purpose of turning a profit. But the prison itself is owned.
It's not the site of other industry, manufacturing, jobs.
It can be. Sure, it absolutely can be, but it doesn't have to be. But people often say prison for profit when what they mean is private prisons.
Right.
And private prisons are a product of the late 20th century. So private prisons did not exist in the 19th century. And the Auburn State Prison was never a private prison. It's still not. It was always a state prison.
Right.
So part of what I'm really doing in Freeman's Challenge, the murder that shook America's original prison for profit, is I'm challenging the idea that a state prison should not be thought of as a prison for profit. My claim is if you have a prison that was established for the purpose of turning a profit and it is run, every aspect of it is run for the purpose of making profits, that's a prison for profit. That's my claim. And when we define prison for profit in this way, then we can see a history that's 200 years old of prison for profit. And I think that's useful to understand that profiteering, prison profiteering, is not a new thing.
And just to sort of flesh that out, and do you find yourself opposed to prisons for profit or prisons for profit that do not pay the employees, which is to say the inmates, a whatever counts as a fair salary? I mean, I suppose you could still defer for the, for the room and board, right?
I think that the fundamental idea that it's okay for one person to profit economically off another person's incarceration, I think that idea is morally abhorrent. I am fundamentally against that idea.
Even though it might be a choice at it, right? No, it's not, you're not compelled as a prisoner. You can choose to work there or not.
Well, that's different from me benefiting economically. So I think that if prisons are going to exist, and prisons do exist, since prisons exist, I think that there are ways to run prisons that are more ethical and that are less ethical. And I am not opposed to work in prisons. Like I said, I want to work as a non-incarcerated person. And if I were incarcerated, I'm sure I'd want to work. But I would want work that is meaningful. I would want work that can give me money that I can use for my own benefit or for the benefit of people I love. And I think that workers' rights are really important. So I am not against work inside or outside of prisons.
No, got that.
I am against the idea that the work of one incarcerated person should economically benefit non-incarcerated people. That, I think, is wrong.
Yeah. I don't have an immediate reaction to that. That particular slice, right? I mean, because that's, well, maybe that's what we are. But because people profit off of the toil of other people all the time, having nothing to do with people. I mean, people, theoretically, people who are in prison are incarcerated because of something they did. That is obviously not always true. And that, you know, so there's that question. But the fact that there's money left over from any enterprise where people are, you know, people are sweating and getting dirty and lifting heavy things and putting in a long day and walking away with maybe it's a satisfactory amount. Often it is not. And other people are profiting to a much better, higher degree. Some people own shares in the company that where that's going on. Similar sorts of moral questions. We could ask similar sorts of moral questions.
Well, the moving questions come up when you have a vulnerable population.
Right.
So we're talking about prisoners. We're talking about a vulnerable population. I am not in favor of profiteering off of prisons. I'm not in favor of prisoners. I'm not in favor of profiteering off of children.
Right.
And what connects these two populations, besides the fact that sometimes children are in prisons, what connects these two populations is that they're vulnerable. They are vulnerable to exploitation.
Right. We could go on about that one. When a person gets fired, they find out how vulnerable they are because, well, you just get a new job. Well,
not so easy.
Yeah. Okay. You get a new job. So it's, you know, some people have more quote marketable skills. They are less vulnerable and other people don't and they are more vulnerable men, but everybody but the person who's laying them off is vulnerable. Right. So there's that. And, I think this story would be missing a punchline, which we spoke about before in our previous conversation, which is what is going on at Auburn Prison today, found fascinating. Like what?
Yeah.
It's still happening. So could you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the Auburn Prison still exists today. It is called the Auburn Correctional Facility. It is the oldest continually operating maximum security prison in the United States. And it still encompasses factories and it still is a site of manufacturing. So not only are they manufacturing license plates, as I mentioned before, they are also manufacturing furniture, just as they did in William Freeman's day. And the factories, and they're manufacturing other items too, other consumer items. The factories are run today by a single corporation and it's called CoreCraft. And people can Google it if you want, CoreCraft. It is a state-run corporation in New York State. And what they do is they oversee manufacturing in all of New York State's prisons. The consumer goods that are manufactured in prisons today are not sold on the open market. This is a difference from William Freeman's day. The way they are sold is only to state markets. So they are the preferred vendor for New York State. So if you go to a New York City public school, which, by the way, I did, I grew up going to New York City public schools, first grade through 12th grade, the furniture in New York's public schools are made in prisons. The furniture in New York's courthouses are made in prisons. So many of the things that you see in a courthouse, and this goes from the furniture to the American flags, to the hand sanitizer, to uniforms for the guards in a courthouse. All of these things are manufactured in New York State prisons. Some of those things are manufactured in Auburn.
Are the institutions that, you know, the schools, the courthouses, et cetera, the state buildings, must they furnish their buildings
yes.
with prison?
Yes, yes. It's CoreCraft is the preferred vendor for New York State. So they have to go to CoreCraft first.
They have to.
Yeah. And so this is, and so you can think about license plates, for example. Like, let's say you want to drive a car in New York State, and let's say you don't want a prison made license plate. Well, tough. You can't buy a license plate for your car anywhere except from New York State. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have a New York State license plate, you can't, there's no competition. Right. You could only buy it from the state, and the state only buys it from the Auburn prison.
Which no doubt pisses off a whole other group of people.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That was true in William Freeman's day and today.
Yeah,
and it's true, by the way, also in California. So in California, a lot of people know that many of the firefighters in California are incarcerated. A lot of people know that. What fewer people know is that in California, there's a prison-run agricultural industry. And if you go into a VA hospital, for example, or a state-run nursing home in California, or a state-run hospital in California, a lot of the food has been manufactured. A lot of the agricultural supplies come from prison farms.
It's interesting. Super interesting. Well, I know you have a hard stop, and so I want to ask you this before. So if we were to stop right now, and, 5 minutes from now, you would say, oh my God, I really wish I had said. So is there something that feels like it really needs to be said before we?
Oh, always. Well, I think one thing is that there is really good organizing across the nation against exploitative prison labor and against forced prison labor. So there are many, many good organizations that are taking this on. And there are movements across the United States to change state constitutions to outlaw forced prison labor, to outlaw modern day slavery. So I encourage your listeners to check out what's happening in their own state. There are some states that have already succeeded in outlawing forced prison labor, not outlawing prison labor. Sure. But outlawing forced prison labor. One of them, for example, is Nevada. Nevada has succeeded. New York State right now is trying to outlaw, or I should say, certain factions of New York State are trying to outlaw forced prison labor in New York State. And this is directly continuing Freeman's challenge. They are making exactly the same claims that William Freeman made almost 200 years ago. So I guess the last thing that I would like to say is that I hope people will check out the book to learn about this enormously brave teenager who took on the emerging system of prison for profit. He took it on legally, and then he took it on illegally. And what he did, what he tried to do, and what happened next is a really unbelievable story. So I hope people will check it out. No easy answers in this story. It's not a comfortable story.
Quick question before we do. So changes to a constitution that would prevent forced prison labor. But that does not mean if it's voluntary, it still doesn't have to be paid.
There are different laws that are under consideration, or different bills that are under consideration in different states.
I get it.
So there are other bills that would address fair payment.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.